Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Well, there's been a lot of question for a lot of time about what happened to that K-bar knife that Brian Koberger used, and possibly another weapon that was used in the slayings of those four innocent college students in Moscow, Idaho, several years ago. He's obviously spending the rest of his life in prison. We've gotten a lot of information from document dumps about how that early investigation went. Learn more about Koberger, what he was like before, after, during the trial. But what about the weapon? What about what else he was doing out there? Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, has some theories. And we've been talking about this for a bit off the air. You've laid out a theory that reframes how we think about the missing K-bar. Instead of a panicked dump, just, you know, tossing it out the window or into a river, you're looking at something much more deliberate, a tactic straight out of the playbook of offenders like Israel Keyes, where a location isn't just scenery, it's part of the operation. I got to ask you, how the hell do we say the name of this park? Waiwai? Waiawea? It sounds Hawaiian, even though it's not.
Waiwai? I don't know the name.
Waiawea County Park. We're going to go with Waiawea County Park. I think that's how you'd say it if you were in Hawaii. I could be completely wrong. Right. Even though we're not talking about Hawaii, this is right there in the Moscow area. That's just the name of the park. Waiawea County Park isn't just a quiet riverside for stargazing. It could be pre-selected prepping spot for him before his excursions, and maybe more than just the one that night. Let's start by dissecting the tactical side here, the terrain, his patterns, and the criminal tradecraft that might point us towards where that knife currently is. What brought you into this line of thinking that maybe he's got a hidey hole, kind of BTK-ish or Israel Keyes-ish? Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, Tony. So this came about just from all the data points and statements that everyone's been making along this entire road. And I remember just sitting with you and watching live the victim statements during the sentencing. And it kind of hit me, it hit us already on this one, but kind of hit me even harder, I think, that, wow, this guy has not done an original thing during this entire process. You know, he is the epitome of a copycat, being Koberger. You know, he emulated so many people. Like, there's four main people, because what I did was, so with that kind of mindset, I'll back up, with that kind of mindset of he did nothing original, and I'll actually go through there's only three things that were original in what he did. Mm-hmm. It wasn't by choice, it was by accident, right? Yeah. So everything else he's done came about, it appears, because of his study under Professor Ramslin.
Yep.
And then when we put that together with Howard Bloom's great book, When Night Comes Falling, and also his statements where he kind of theorized and had some conjecture that he was doing certain things to impress her, and then kind of superimposing it with our thoughts of maybe not try to impress her, but maybe be a study for her, because, you know, let's go looking at him. If we want to take that leap, because without a diagnosis of what we've done, but take that leap of he has a high level of psychopathy, because he definitely looks like he's got a high level of psychopathy with his totally known emotional effect, mm-hmm. being able to do what he does. And so with that, it's all about grandiosity, and grandiosity is trying to outdo someone. It's about having the attention on them. And so with that kind of conjecture and theories running around in my head, I was like, well, let's then look at the murder weapon. Let's look at what's taken place and what hasn't taken place. And so if everything he's done has been a copycat of who he studied under Ramsland, who under Ramsland, what have they done with murder weapons after the effect, mm-hmm. after the fact of what has happened? And that's when I zeroed in on Keys and saw that Keys had stashes both before he committed murder across the country. He would make these weapons caches and these murder caches for just in case. So he wouldn't have to travel with weapons to be alerting. He wouldn't have to travel with any paraphernalia that would be alerting. He would place things in barrels and in tubs months, if not years ahead of time, just in case that he could be impulsive and commit a murder in a certain location. And so he would also do that after the fact. He would secrete whatever he used back into a secret place. He could either use it as a trophy. He could reminisce and think about it after the fact. And he might even use it again. And so I was looking at this and thinking to myself, if he's been a copycat on everything, being Kohlberger, everything he's done to date so far, why wouldn't he do his post-murder just like everyone he studied before? So that brought me to Keys. And then what I did was I'll let you take it from here. Otherwise, I'll keep rambling.
No, I mean, there's a lot of questions here. I mean, continue with how your thought process was on this and how you kind of got to where you did with Keys.
So what I then did was, again, all public records. And so I think there's a great opportunity for law enforcement to do a deeper dive on this, because this is what I also researched. I didn't see any results doing my research that anyone's done this yet. Doesn't mean law enforcement hasn't.
Sure.
But from the public records, we don't have records of this. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I then analyzed. I said, where did Keys typically put his caches, both mostly after the event happened, like where he put the weapon, where he put the clothing he's looking at. And it always came back to places like in bends of rivers, in state parks, in all these kinds of places that Kohlberger would frequent.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what I did was I did some research. I said, I used AI for this, like law enforcement does these days. They use AI to kind of triangulate a lot of data rapidly. And so what I did was I then did a triangulation the best I could of the types of places that Keys would secrete weapons in a cache after an event. And then I did an overlay of Kohlberger's route after the murder as well, mm-hmm. to see what types of places. And I came up with four probable locations, like a bend in a river, someplace in the park and things like that. And also, Tony, there's one other thing that triggered me in on doing this. Kohlberger himself gave leakage in a sense that he said his alibi was out stargazing and, again, hiding in plain sight. So then I did research. Is this park, where in this park is known for stargazing? Because if you look at where in the park is known for stargazing, since he gave it as leakage, this might be a place he's more comfortable with. He can frequent without actually not arising suspicion. And there's one more thing in here that they haven't done yet, that they haven't disclosed in the records. This is where I'd be very, very curious about law enforcement going down and taking a look at as well. Kohlberger took a very tunnel vision look at what to do pre-murder and execution of murder when it came to digital footprint. He turned off his cell phone only on the day he's committing the murder. And they have through cell phone traffic from the months leading up to it that he actually went by the house a certain number of times because he didn't turn it off then, which he should have done, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have all the cell phone traffic data around there, and we have the night of him circling down through the park on his way home. What I'm curious about is from the time he moved to Washington to go to the university there, I want to look at that cell phone data going through that park area. I want to see stops, but I also want to know when it was turned off. I want to know the areas it turned off. And I think we might be able to do an overlay between what I saw from a similarities between where Keys placed his and where the AI is saying that these are some likely potential locations to check. And when you actually throw cell phone assessment data on top of that, we might have some pings, pure conjecture, of where he might have stashed the bloody clothes, because blood is also going to be a trophy, something to remember. The knife, and all these things that he might be reminiscing about more than a selfie in a shower where he's smiling and grinning like a psycho.
Do you? I mean, it makes you wonder. Is like he's still sitting there in that cell, like hoping maybe one day I'll get back to that hole that I dug in the ground. And the thing is, if he did in fact hide these items somewhere in a park in a hole, is there any incentive for him to admit this out loud and to say this, or is it better that it's sitting there and safe there for him should he ever want to return? Obviously, I don't think he planned on getting caught. He planned on having this kind of as a place to return to, not just to get his stuff, but also to revisit and to commiserate, to view his trophies and fantasize. Yes, that's the word I'm looking for.
So we just simply look at, you know, when we have these types of questions, I think the best place to go for the answers is the place that he went for his inspiration for everything. He's got four main people that he was emulating the entire time. And we look at what they did. And in this case, definitely BTK. He kept stuff, you know, he's in jail for the rest of his life in prison. And so he didn't reveal everything right away. He leaks it out to keep the attention on himself. Yeah. So here's a theory. So if we have four people, we got BTK, we got Ted Bundy, we got Keys, and there was one other that he's been emulating, one other in there that he's been emulating a lot of, because those are who Ramsland studied mostly. Mm-hmm. Her books, her writings are on those four, right?
Yeah.
And so if we're looking for answers on what a probability of what he'll do next is, let's just follow one of those. I'm going down the BTK road, mm-hmm. and that is, when he eventually gets out of solitary that he's in right now, if that happens, because he will be under severe threat because the conclaves are going to get him.
That's not going to work out well when that happens.
Right. And as he very bluntly said, the big D's coming for you.
He better get his story out now, whatever he wants to get out.
Yeah.
Because I think he may be a bit incapacitated shortly.
So when he first starts having the capacity to communicate, I'll be really curious as to the leakage he might start giving, because if it's there, eventually he might start leaking it to keep that attention. It's going to come in the form of, and again, I don't think he's motivated. Well, I don't think, who the hell knows what I think, but his motivation seems to be the attention, not the profit. So him writing a book, or someone writing a book or doing a study on him, I think that's when it's going to come out. And so I think and it's going to come out in drips and droves, not because it's his choice, but that's because what BTK did. That's what all these other people did. Or anyone else he might wind up studying while he's in there. And for what purpose? So let's go down for what's the motive. So if we're going to go down Howard Bloom's, and again, I give a lot of deference to people that have actually done a deeper study or dive, because they've interviewed so many people, including the journalist that worked with James Patterson and his book. Like, I think they did 300 interviews for that one, she said.
Yeah, she was out there quite a bit.
Yeah, and so when you look at that, you look at their data points and see what ideas they come up with, they have credibility to me. Not that that's exactly right, but you got to look at it. And this idea of Ramsland really, really resonated with me. But now it was how, like from what effect, for what purpose. And I think it really is to the grandiosity, to be in her mind, the most interesting thing that she wants to study for the rest of her life would be success in his mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes you wonder what exactly his thinking was beforehand. Clearly we know that Koberger liked to emulate other people. There seems to be kind of his identity. He's one of those who just took bits and pieces from BTK, from Bundy. There's nods to fictional characters like Bates Motel, the Norman Bates psycho, American Psycho, the Papa Roger, Elliot Rogers.
That's the other one. Yeah, that's the other one too. Yep.
There's all these, it's like he's a cornucopia of all these different characters, but not really knowing who exactly he is. So it's not shocking, the idea here that he's also, you know, would be emulating the idea of burying these things like Israel Keyes did, or like BTK did. What do you think, Robin? I mean, initially, if he started this, and I'm going to call it a hidey hole, because that's what BTK called his, what would you, how do you think that started? Did it start prior to committing crimes, or was this more in the time window, you think, when maybe he was committing some of these smaller crimes where he was breaking and entering into homes? He's suspected of that in several different areas. Yeah, obviously they found the ID cards in his glove box, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's things like that that initially began this hidey hole, or is it a combination where it's his trophies, but it's also maybe where he hides the weapon, where he keeps it out of his own home so they can't find it, but it's also a place where he can go get it when he wants to use it, which maybe he very well did that night in November with the Idaho 4.
Yeah, well, all of these things are those, that escalation of that life arc that he had, and even the break-ins that, the suspected break-ins that he was tied to or potentially tied to that are coming out in the court release documents. That just confirms more of what was suspected, and that all these people back in his hometown in Pennsylvania are putting together after the fact too, that mm-hmm. came out in Patterson's book. So that's just following an arc of, you know, just deviant, unhealthy behavior that typically does come about with these type of people in the murder realm. What was interesting too was the idea of, and it's been confirmed even more so with the course, the court documents being released, that they still have not found any, even though I know Howard Bloom thinks it was all about the one girl, there's still no conclusive link between him and any of the victims. And as we now know, he had bought that K-bar knife prior to his going out to Idaho
way
for
before
school.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're looking at, and he'd started studying criminology before going out to Idaho. So mm-hmm. if you're looking at that arc, I think it was always in his mind to do this for quite some time. And so that's why going out there and laying down a cache mm-hmm. before he even selected a venue and individuals possibly is exactly because that's what Keys did. He was opportunistic, creating a cache for something he's going to be using when the time comes for him to use it. Mm-hmm. And I really think that that's a probability of this happening here. Because so let's just go law of probability. Sometimes you can be off and sometimes you can be on with me on laws of probability. But when you come down to Koberger's behavior, again, the research I did, everything he did in the execution of this completely aligns with four other people. We said Dennis Rader, Bundy, Keys, and Papa Roger, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with that, the only things that do – so it's easy now. Let's look at what doesn't align. The only things that happened that did not align with something that someone else emulated ahead of time is leaving two victims because that it mm-hmm. was not part of his plan, right? Leaving a knife sheet behind – and returning to the scene of the crime so soon after, because I found that interesting. They said that returning to the scene of the crime is like, how could that be new? How could that be original? Actually, it's the idea of return to scene of the crime wasn't original. So soon after the event was the part that kind of broke a norm from that pattern. So if mm-hmm. you're looking at everything he did, there's only those three things that stand out that are outside the pattern of what he's emulated in someone else. So why wouldn't getting rid of the weapon be the same?
Yeah, I mean, and the thing, I mean, there's a lot of killers that he could have emulated where they did throw it into a river. But the fact that we see that he goes to these parks in terms of his yep. his vehicle patterns, and that's a big question because I don't know how far back they looked at these vehicle patterns. They obviously did for some amount of time where they could tell that he was stalking them. I just wonder how far it goes back. I mean, does it go back even further than what they looked at? Because I think there's a big possibility that there is something in these parks other than knowing the fact that he hit these parks. You know, before the crime and he would go there quite frequently from his other vehicle activity. How do we begin to think about where in the park these things might be located? These are big areas of space, as all parks are. They're very wooded. They're not just like, hey, here's the park on the corner with a playground. This is like wooded area, hiking trail type territory. I guess my thought would be, look back to Israel Keys, look back to Robert Hansen, look back to BTK, the types of places maybe they would have hid things, or more so in that sort of atmosphere. How do we get down to where, if somebody wants to try and find this, how do they go about doing it?
Yeah, so I did that. And again, I don't have real-time data because I'm not there.
Sure.
But when you do that overlays, the typical place that Keys would do these things is bends in rivers. They always near water. Near water because it allows you to secrete it in a hiding place as well as expose it in that body of water if you chose to do that as well in a last-minute boo-boo, right?
Yeah.
But also you want it to be easy to access and explain away on your typical route, but also not frequented by other people. That's why these parks, these walking trails, there's lots of probability of those being the locations. And when looking at these, and so bring it to the spirals, you mentioned Hansen. We were given, I remember this was so funny. We were given tips by defector sources, high-level Russian defector sources, of where they had caches that they... So what happens is when you have a Russian illegal, when a Russian illegal is placed in our country years and decades in advance of ever being needed, typically what they're doing is they're placed in this country just in case things sour between us and that nation in Russia, and we kick all the diplomats out.
Mm-hmm.
We kick all the diplomats out of the diplomatic establishment. What happens is Russia will activate their illegals network to continue collecting intelligence outside of the normal pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, they have to first go to a cache of cache, information, coding equipment, transmission, all, you know, a cache of tradecraft that allows them to act in those capacities. And actually, we had had information that told us where those caches were.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, because this is a test, oh my God, I've dug so many holes in parks. Because
you literally have.
I have. And so what happens is they typically say it's down this trail, approximately 200 feet next to a dead tree stump.
Mm-hmm.
Go.
Yeah.
I can tell you. You try digging around a dead tree stump about 200 feet down, you're going to wind up digging 500 holes and not finding anything. So that's a long answer, a Robin Dreek answer of saying, it's got to be an obvious place as well, obvious for him to be able to find again. That's why it's a bend, an actual bend in the river. It's got to be a part of nature that is immobile, and will be there for a period of time to trigger a memory so he can actually dig it up again, but also not so obvious that someone else would. So I was looking, that's why I saw me scrolling. I was looking for the sites. There's about five sites that overlaid that I did with the research between where Keys buried his and actually in the park itself.
Mm-hmm.
And one of, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I'm going to try to dig them up now, but yes, I have five locations where I think there's the highest probability. And because the police, I'd have no idea because they haven't released exactly where anyone has actually searched before.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge, and I know they analyzed the dirt on the shovel that he found, and it was inconclusive on, they didn't say whether it led to anything or not.
And that's a big piece of this, the shovel itself. Yeah. I mean, let's talk about it.
Yeah, see? He had a shovel.
Because that's what really kind of starts us, not only the fact that he's on the map going to these parks, but the fact that there's a shovel, and it's not a snow shovel. It's a literal, let's dig a hole in the ground shovel. It's not I got stuck on the side of the road. Let me dig out of the snow. So, and there's dirt. So they did try to do some sort of a evaluation of the soil and compare it to different areas. I don't know that was very conclusive. At least they didn't release it. As far as we know anything at this moment in time about, oh, this might be where it is. But they clearly had it in their mind. Is this something that they would still be even looking for in an investigative technique or an investigative platform? Or is this now pretty much up to the true crime community? If you want to find the knife, the investigation is done. We're not looking for it anymore because it doesn't really matter at this point in terms of prosecution.
Boy, that's a tough question. I'm thinking it's going to be up to the true crime community more so only because you know, law enforcement departments have limited bandwidth.
Yeah.
You know, and you have, if you have other things you have to work on, and this guy's already serving four life sentences behind the bars and you already got the conviction, the resources, yep, energy to kind of look for that, it's going to be limited. Yep. The other thing too, you mentioned, I wanted to mention too, is you were talking about the cell phone data. I don't know how far back the subpoena went to get the cell phone traffic. A lot, because anytime you get anytime you're using an intrusive technique like collecting cell phone information, whether content or just triangulation and getting pings, yeah, you have to be able to justify to a judge as to this is reasonable amount, yep, of time for this. And I don't know if it went back to his entire time since he moved to Idaho. Mm-hmm. I would think they could probably justify it. If not back then, they could definitely justify now. Just the things we talked about on this podcast, yeah, right here would be enough for a judge to sign off and get more cell phone.
Yeah, I would think if they're trying to look into possible other crimes at this point, and that's where I think, mm-hmm, it's valuable, where it might not be anything. I mean, it'd be lovely to find it, but at the same point, it's not going to affect his life sentence. He's right. He's gone. It's there. It's done. But it does make you wonder what else might be in this box. If it points to other crimes that actually had been committed that are unsolved, obviously nothing to this degree in that general vicinity, but other crimes. I mean, the fact that he had, and let's talk about this. The fact that Brian Koberger had two ID cards in his glove box of two women that were, we don't know who they were exactly. They haven't released that, but they were not his victims. They were not any of the victims in that house. These women are still alive. They may not even know Brian Koberger had their IDs. As far as they know, they lost it and then probably have it replaced by now. But let's talk about that, because his hidey hole there was his glove box in a car that was described as being disassembled. I want to get your reaction to that idea first. This man, scrupulous with his cleaning, obviously leaves, yeah, the scene, doesn't have blood on him, at least nothing that anyone ever observed. We don't have the clothing. There was just the little bit of DNA on the knife sheath. He cleans the car to a level they say literally is disassembled. They find nothing in it, but they find IDs in the glove box. That just seems really idiotic to me. Like, you cleaned the hell out of your car and you left two IDs from two people who are not you in your glove box. That's extremely suspicious. Is this just Koberger being stupid, going, well, I didn't think to check the glove box? Or what the hell do you think that is that was left in there?
Conjecture and me are go hand in hand sometimes. So the only thing I can really think of, so he's really good in his stovepipe of making sure he didn't have anything related to the murder out of that car. So that's why those two IDs, I don't think were related to the murder or anything related,
no,
probably to murder in his head. But what kind of things can IDs be used for? Obviously the photos, you can use them for understanding who you might want to stalk. But if he's equating that to the same way in his head as what he just done, he would have probably removed them, or he was just stupid and forgot, mm-hmm, which is also, it's a possibility, but he then tends to not do that. I'd be curious where those IDs are from, because maybe he wanted to get access to something else, mm-hmm, and he wanted to use those to understand how to get access to something, maybe make a clone of one of those things. I don't know. There's, again, just down to conjecture, there's a lot of things IDs could be used for.
Was it
for targeting. What?
Was it for any sort of use, or was it just for a control? Was it just for feeling that control of, I got this from them? I mean, it's, there's no reason to have anyone else's ID on your person. There's very few reasons I can think of. Like, you're, yeah, going down the water slide? Okay, I'll hold on to your ID for you. I mean,
you know, and we do know that he was not treating these female students very well at all.
No.
If they're from females, he could have literally just taken them and found them just to screw with them.
Yeah.
Because he is vengeful. He is very vengeful. And we have data points on him being vindictive and vengeful. So, mm-hmm, it could have been just for that. Again, anytime you have an outlier of new data that comes in that just kind of spikes, there's lots of, I'm completely wide open to anything those could be, but it could just be a simple vengeful thing he did too.
I'm wondering if you know, all of this started really early, you know, because we know he was committing some petty crimes. He stole his sister's phone. His dad turned him in. We know all that. And there are people there in the new book that that came out, the James Patterson one that talks about
Idaho 4, right?
Yeah, where it talks about him going into like a family friend. He was friends with the son and broke in or took things from the mom. The mom figured it out. Eventually, gets called on the carpet for
$20,000 worth of, yeah, if not more,
like, yeah, serious theft. But yeah, isn't turned in for it. He apologizes when he's called out eventually, and just kind of goes on his way. And she says, I don't ever want to see you again. And he's like, okay, bye. So he's doing this before. I'm just wondering, did this start, I don't want to say benign, but benign compared to a execution of four people, where it was smaller things he was doing? And was it for his craft of wanting to get into law enforcement? And was it to do smaller things to try and gain insight from what it would be like, the perspective of the perpetrator? And then eventually, after breaking into houses so many times and stealing ID cards and jewelry, he eventually ups the game and goes, well, I got away with this so much. How hard would it be to go in and kill somebody too, and then get that in his repertoire of his mind of experience? That's where I'm wondering on him. And it's honestly what I've been saying from the very beginning on Koberger.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I think at the onset, from when I looked at the timing of it, I think the original thefts he was doing, and I think it was, again, it's hard to, I'm having a hard time placing exactly what Patterson had found out in his book, but a lot of his thefts he was doing actually, I think, was giving him the cash he needed to get drugs. So sure, a lot of it was drug related stuff. And so that's part of that arc of him getting reps earlier, yeah, on. But that kind of goes to a question I've been asking myself a lot about him, and that's the motivation. I had theorized, and some others had too, that, you know, when you're dealing with Koberger and him talking about having no emotions and having that visual snow and all the things that go along with psychopathy, which is that no emotional effect for anything, of him upping the sensations of what he was doing to get some sort of emotional response to something, kind of like, you know, we saw that emotional response, he's doing a selfie in the shower afterwards as his trophy, mm-hmm, or a theorized trophy. And then, so you have that aspect of it as a potential motivation. But then when I started thinking more about this Ramson thing and the grandiosity of it, I don't think they're necessarily, you know, independent. They could be definitely together on this. There's also the possibility that he wasn't out to actually, in other words, murder and the emotion behind the murder might not have been the pure motivation. It could also have been the grandiosity of being better than these other serial killers. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be you have to murder someone in order to get that kind of attention. Because that's what really, what made me think about that was his incessant hand washing and showering he was doing and reported to have done. That is, you know, it's interesting. It's just one data point, and I've seen that behavior with others before that have done something or been part, like you see it with people that have done things that they have shame over. Mm-hmm. Again, I didn't do a deeper research on this to update my knowledge base on this, but I've seen it from people that are suffering, having done something, been part of something that they just want to get the memory off of them. So they actually become neurotic like that. Look, I'm just really curious about
it's
that.
It's a common human thing to do. I mean, honestly, like, I can tell you, and I've seen it, and I've talked to many of people where, you know, after a breakup, after something really big that's happened and has come to a close, and not necessarily that you feel shame over, but you feel, you know, a sense of change, a sense of loss. I can guarantee the best times I've cleaned my pantry and really narrowed it down was after a breakup, where you just, there's something about going and cleaning and refreshing things that helps. But I wonder, you know, but the thing is, with something like this, it's Koberger, so we're on a totally different level. He's in the prison, he's in jail, and he's washed. It's not like you're like going to get some extra blood off your hands that they're going to find.
It's not that. It's a psychological thing. And that's why I'd be curious about his patterns, if he did that before he did the murders or after. Because again, the just having an effect. In other words, I'm curious if doing those actual murders had a positive effect he was looking for, a negative effect, because that kind of then goes into my mind. Was it more for the Ramsland attention or not? Mm-hmm. Again, tons of ideas thrown through my head on this one because there's so many different little nuggets that are coming out that are kind of constantly building and shifting this thing around. But going to the original thing we're talking about,
yeah,
the probability of him having secreted the murder weapon and maybe even the clothes into a hidey hole.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a decent probability of that.
I do too. Back to the cards, though. Was that just a dumb mistake on his part that he left those damn things there? You disassemble the car and you leave possible evidence. I mean, not of this crime, but they're going to wonder what the hell you got this for. I mean, is that just a, oh shit, like I didn't touch the glove box during any of this. I've cleaned everything that I possibly could have touched and just forgot.
I think it's both. I think it's him being stupid
because
he has a lot of stupid in him as well as unrelated to this.
Yeah, very narrow but shift in thinking. Like that's a different thing.
He's very narrow in his focus.
That makes a little more sense, I think, when you think of it that way, of why that would be there. And it's just so foolish at the same time of he thinks he's this genius over here and like, look, the obvious is right there. It's like leaving the sheath. Like, you did everything good, but.
You know, I'm not liking, you know, a lot of people said he was so smart or all these different things.
I don't agree with that.
Neither do I. I think he's an idiot.
Socially, completely. I mean, was he... I think he's like a lot of people where I do think he could pass an IQ test with a pretty high score, but that doesn't necessarily mean socially he's very smart on how to handle anything.
I'm gonna say he's only gonna be average, and
really?
Here's why, Tony. Yeah, you know, because he did not execute all this information in his head at a high level.
But and I don't think again, people with high IQs do that because they're operating in a different zone. And when you actually apply it to the real world, it doesn't apply unless everything is within their own control, which clearly with this, it was not.
But I think he has the appearance of a high IQ to some only because he doesn't sleep.
Yeah.
So I've known a lot of people. I went to the United States Naval Academy. I was surrounded by extremely brilliant people.
Mm-hmm.
And I also witnessed people that weren't as brilliant, but all of a sudden were able to do very, very well academically because they put in a lot of time and effort and energy into doing X, Y, and Z. And when you look at Koberger, he put in a lot of time, effort, and energy into X, Y, and Z of what he was doing. So I don't think, to me, just seeing reps from other really, really brilliant people I've seen in my life, because not being on the low end of it, he strikes me as someone that just put in a lot of time, energy, and effort that others weren't willing to do that might have been more intelligent and more talented. Because, I mean, just look at the people that he was studying. Mm-hmm. All of them did a much better job than he did.
That's true. No, that's very true.
So, because he has... I guess I'm equating emotional intelligence. Obviously, he's got zero to IQ as well, which they're different.
Which you can be really strong. If you're really strong on one, you're probably not really strong on the other.
He has zero EQ, zero emotional intelligence. Yeah. And I think he only strikes me as moderate on IQ. And again, it's effort level that I think really got him to notice the people. Because, I mean, who is into this kind of stuff as much to the degree and actually had the bandwidth to dedicate it? I love stuff that pops in our mind as we're going. So all other people that he's studying with, they all have something he doesn't. Social life.
Mm-hmm.
Social life takes up a lot of bandwidth from normal human beings. And so when you're a professor and you're looking at your pool of students and you're looking at grade, you're looking at effort, and you're looking at all these things, who's going to stand out as being exceptional? The one that is dedicating 100% of all the energy and everything they're doing to the craft that the professors there are caring about. Meanwhile, all these other students can be very, very good students, but they actually have life that is actually infiltrating into their performance. I know this because, you know, I have two kids that are very into what they do, and they're talented and exceptional. At the same time, though, they're able to excel because their bandwidth allows them to excel because they're focusing on their craft and not on the chaos that other people are focused on. So I really think... He didn't strike me as anything great. He struck me as someone that emulated a lot of people and just think about this. He put so much time and energy into what he was doing. You think he'd be better at it?
You would. You win. He's loser. Someone who I think, like many of us do, though. I mean, I identify with what we do or our craft as part of, you know, who we are, a very big part, more than just, yeah, I do this and my whole life is over here. Sometimes it's very intertwined. I feel like he found worth, because I think it was one of the few things in his life that actually, you know, he was somewhat good at compared to others, but obviously not perfect by any stretch of the imagination.
And validated for it. You know, when you have a professor saying you're doing well, doesn't matter how good or bad you are at something. I mean, how many of us at a young age, because that becomes part of our life arc, we pursue things. I mean, Tony, you're a great example. You fell in love with doing radio and doing this kind of work at a young age of 14 because
no, actually
along the
two,
way,
but
see what I mean?
On it the air, officially on the air, but I've been talking to on mic since two.
Spark and inspiration all those years ago. Yep. And so because someone along the way, a situation probably validated you that you're good at it. And so when someone gives you that kind of affirmation that it allows you to feel safe, allows you to feel valued, you're going to get the reps in because those reps become rewarding to you both from the outer and the inner. And so when he was rewarded finally for the first time in his life for studying after he overcame drugs, after he got in shape and he lost the weight, he's going to now follow that arc of criminology, and he's going to do it obviously in an extremely unhealthy way in the end. So I think that became part of that arc as you were just talking about.
I agree. Let's talk about Koberger's sleeping habits, because you brought that up. You brought up earlier, you know, he doesn't sleep, and that's what we've been hearing in newly released documents about his time in jail. This guy, I didn't know you could be up in jail late at night. I thought they kind of made you go to sleep, but I guess they don't. So he's up, he's disturbing the other inmates because he's moving around, he's doing stuff. I mean, it's you know, you look at Koberger and he's fairly vampiric, which he's just his image, the vibe he gives off. What do you make of that? I mean, and is that a common thing amongst killers that of the past? Is he emulating someone? I wonder about that. I haven't really dug into that. I don't know. Of staying up late and whatever the hell he's up to, he's doing it in odd hours. He's not necessarily doing it in daylight, it seems.
I think that just goes to it again, pure conjecture on this one too. I just think his brain is so broken, the chemical imbalances in there, it throws off everything, you know, because sleep is regulated mostly by melatonin and our body's natural rhythm. He doesn't have one probably. And so it throws it all off. Plus, I mean, you can't even imagine what the hell's going on in that brain. You know, the kind of machinations it's going through and running through and scenarios it's running through. Because again, that he fixates on things, as we've seen. He's OCD in a lot of things he does. And so that's probably what's happening in that brain is it just gets wound up and just keeps going, probably around really inane things that aren't going very far or effective at all. Because if you think about it, here's someone that's up all the time studying so much, and he's still sucked at what he did.
Yeah. Is prison going to bring, how do you think prison's going to affect Koberger? If he's, because obviously he's only been there for a little while. I know he's been in jail, but this is prison. And he's in solitary confinement right now and will be for the foreseeable future. That can do a number on a lot of people. Look at Richard Allen, the man accused of being the Delphi murder, which obviously we don't agree with. But that threw him for an insanity, made him psychotic. He was suffering psychosis. He was eating his own feces. He was running his head into a wall. And he wasn't even convicted yet, but that's a whole other story. That can mess with you. Do you think this is going to be something that Koberger thrives in? Because it's a very bizarre, unhealthy than the norm situation, and most would really hate this. Or is this something where this is going to make him, you know, more deep in some ways in terms of his thinking, because it allows him more time to just focus on his madness? And or is this really going to exacerbate his madness and make it come to light of just how utterly crazy his thinking is if he tries to speak aloud at some point?
Boy, it's hard to say. I I only know the effect of isolation on a healthy brain and healthy people, as we've seen with Richard Allen, mm-hmm. but also throughout time, the first explorers in the Arctic or anywhere in the world, or even people that get stranded on islands, it shows the effect of us emotionally. That's why they do these great studies all the time of, prolonged space travel. If we ever want to go to Mars, mm-hmm. They do a big study in this because psychologically it takes a special kind of person to be able to handle that. On a broken brain, though, there's so many different kinds of broken brains. I don't know what that would do. I'm going to take a deeper look at the research. But here's what I don't think will happen. He doesn't have deep thoughts. He doesn't strike me because he's so hollow. He's so empty. If he is as high on psychopathy as he appears to be, that there's not a lot going on in there. I don't think isolation is going to give him any kind of life epiphany where mm-hmm. there's going to be an aha moment. I mean, just look at the other serial killer. Again, he's not a serial killer technically. He's just a mass murderer because he killed four. Mm-hmm. But you look at other mass murderers that became serial killers. They haven't had, a lot of them haven't had this profound, life-changing, life-altering, like Malcolm X did when he went to prison, kind of moment where like we studied, we became better human beings, we took the opportunity. I don't see that happen with Kolberg at all. I think he's going to either remain completely the same or it's going to break him further.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens with any of that. And if we do find out that he was connected to any other crimes. There's another one that was brought up. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. It was a break-in that occurred before he would have actually been in Moscow. I believe, people will correct me on this, but roughly 6 to 9 months before, I don't have the actual date in front of me. It was in Pullman, Washington. It was a sorority house. There was, you probably read about this already, mm-hmm. A man with a knife came in wearing essentially a ski mask type thing and stood in front of a woman's bed with a knife. She kicked him in the stomach. He fled. And that was that. But it was quite a brazen type attack. You're going into a house that's filled with women in the night with a knife, and you're thinking you're somehow going to get away with something. I mean, this wasn't like she's alone in her dorm in a quiet place that nobody's at. It's a house with people. Granted, this was a house with people that he killed, almost everybody in and got away. But that's what was also interesting about it is it does kind of have some parallels of a lot of guts or just really bad calculations and very poor choices for targeting something like that. But again, quite a bit before he would have officially moved there, we don't have anything that says he was in that area of the country at that point in time.
Right.
But curious nonetheless.
Yeah, it's definitely curious. I'd be curious because I think he did this to a large extent, well, to some extent anyway, and that's rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a data point collection rehearsal. I remember there was one time after 9/11 in New York, because I was in New York during 9/11, and I lived just north of the city. I remember I'm at the mall with my family, and this was when my kids are very small and we're going to go see a movie. And I remember in the movie theater, there was a guy that was walking through the lobby as we're coming out. And this was in the middle of summer.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's hot. They had shorts and t-shirts on, and he's walking out and he's got a big overcoat, kind of like the guy that just did the double murder homicide where you live, Tony. He's completely in black. He's got a hoodie up. He's got a long black trench coat and he's carrying something long under his jacket. And I remember I told my family, get out. I went to talk to the manager. The manager said, yeah, I've alerted mall security. I called in. So I'm now tracking this guy through the mall, and he goes into a restaurant across from the movie theater, and he's sitting in the booth by himself, just sitting there like this, black trench overcoat. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm about to watch this guy do a mass hit at the mall here. And so the cops come up, and the cops go in and confront him. And he's actually carrying a rubber M16.
It was a dry run.
He was doing a dry run.
Shit.
So the possibility of someone like Kolberg or Kolberg himself doing dry runs ahead of time to gain data to find out what the response time is, see what the effect of people is. Because seeing the effect that he has in a house, whether it's Kolberg or someone else, looking menacing, how long does it take for someone to do something about it? Would they say something about it? How long does it take for cops to respond to a complaint like that? Mm-hmm. That then gives him data how long he has to escape. And so criminals doing dry runs like that, that's pretty common. Well, I don't know how common it is. It's what they'll do.
And he was checking the police scanner right before he did this. I'm gonna guess that wasn't the first time he checked the police scanner. I'm going to guess that he was checking it that night. I don't know what that would have told him about that night, if they were just in the general area or if there was other calls they were focusing on or what. But I'm going to guess he checked it at other times, too, for other things that he allegedly may have done to see, well, what's the response time here or there? That I found interesting about checking it before the night of the actual crime. What does that tell you?
It would... One of my theories on this one is he was targeting location more than he was targeting people.
Mm-hmm.
I've said that throughout this just because I think this house made it an easier target for him. And in one way you identify that is by how much traffic is coming in and out through law enforcement presence.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of things are happening that you're seeing there. Is it because people are loud, because there's parties and there's a lot of people in and out? That's what he was looking for. If he's looking for venue first and then who's in that venue that I can target. I think it was a perfect storm for him that he did both.
Yeah.
And so I think, listening to a scanner is going to tell you, it's going to tell you schedules of law enforcement, when their turnovers, their shifts are, because that's an opportune time to do it too during turnovers. So there's a little bit more chaos. During the nighttime, there's definitely not as much presence. You're also looking at who's on. I mean, Grant, these are things I'm coming up with. Mm-hmm. Who knows what he's coming up with, but you're looking at who's on duty, who's actually has a reputation of being on their game and who's not on their game in the world of law enforcement. Again, there's only 37 sworn officers in Moscow. So it's a small department.
Yeah.
And out of those 37, how many are on patrol? So these cops have reps, they have, an image. So those are all data points he could be collecting and taking in just by having a scanner ahead of time. But again, I might probably given him way too much credit because he did not have the maturity and didn't have the reps of understanding how law enforcement actually worked. And why do we know that?
Mm-hmm.
Because he bagged up his trash and put in his neighbor's trash.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, I got to ask this because I know the audience is still sitting there going, okay, what happened with the guy in the mall? I want to ask you, were you packing? Were you ready to draw if you saw him pull something? And what happened to him?
Yeah, so I actually was behind a pillar. I sent my family out of the mall to safety.
Yeah.
And I was standing behind a pillar thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to shoot someone.
Mm-hmm.
I work counterintelligence. Me drawing a gun in 22 years, it happened once on a bank robbery call that we did as a group. But I was thinking I was going to have to potentially shoot this guy until the cops showed up because I was watching him and seeing what he's going to do. And if he's going to make a move, I was saying to myself, well, I was going through my deadly force policy.
Mm-hmm.
I was making sure it's going to be a good shoot if I had to, so I could, live through this, defend other people through this. So what happened is cops came in, they interviewed him, and they determined that he was not a threat, and they sent him on his way because he didn't do anything illegal. But they detained him because he was suspicious and able to actually get enough identifying stuff on him. Where he went from there, luckily, I never saw a shooting at the mall after that. Yeah. So,
but isn't that disturbing? I mean, right after 9/11, the whole "it's see something, say something" prime time in New York.
That was December. I remember that was December of 2001.
And they're just sending this guy on his way.
Law is law. It's an amazing thing. It's amazing. My time in the Bureau was it had moments. And I remember there's many times, like I worked a lot with the CIA and other three-letter agencies. And I remember there's many times when the CIA, we knew someone was doing something horrendous on behalf of a foreign government. And like disclosure of classified information.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of them. We knew someone that was having disclosure of classified or mishandling, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing we had on this person was mishandling the classified, even though we had suspicions it was going to the place it shouldn't go. But at the time, we only had mishandling classified, which is a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we'll have the CIA come in and saying, why don't you just arrest him and put him in jail and throw away the key? I'm like, that's nice, but we have this really cool thing called the Constitution.
Yes.
The things I couldn't do because I was law enforcement and federal law enforcement were pretty intense.
Yeah.
When I retired, I could do so much more research on a human being than I could when I was in, when I was like, I could not do open source information searches on an individual unless I had a case open on them. There's a lot of things I couldn't do because I was a federal law enforcement officer upholding the Constitution of the United States, which meant I was under rules and regulations of what I couldn't do regarding a human being. Mm-hmm. And the amount of focus I could give on them, reasonableness, because that's always what courts go by. So it was pretty limiting.
What it did mean, as you know, on the surface, as you know, a citizen, you know, a bystander out here, one would go, why wouldn't you get him? But at the same point, I'm going to hope that they did start to, like, this guy's on the radar now. Like, yeah, like let him back to wherever he's coming from, and let's see who else he has with him, because that could end up opening up another big cell of something if it was going to be something by letting him free. I'm going to guess that's where it went, more than just let's lock him up for a few days. And
100%. So now what happens? So someone like that becomes a data point, and that data point, you have home of record, you have criminal history, you have vehicle history. You have all these different things. You now have a friends and associates that you can now identify if they actually were asked him to take a look at his, back then we had flip phones. We didn't have full cell phones yet. You know, so they could actually ask, you know, in other words, they're detaining him so they can voluntarily ask for certain things. And if he responds and they can get it, becomes a lot of data points. And so those data points then say, are you the, what network of individuals are you part of? Is this associated with something we already know that's going on because we have intel, we have an investigation over here, so you're another leg of that, or are you going to start a whole new one? So it's not just like they let them go, or we let anyone go after someone displays suspicious activity and it's just a dead deal.
Sure.
No, if we see this in cases, when people let that stuff go, then when something horrendous happens, someone says, all the red flags were there. Why didn't law enforcement do something? Mm-hmm. Since I never heard of anything coming back to this again in a negative way, it meant they used that data in a productive way to shut down whatever it was. Or this guy was just a lone wolf moron out doing something stupid that day, testing law enforcement because he's a pain in the ass.
True.
You know, there's a lot of stupid out there in the world, and he might have just been one of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other. It's not always as deep and dark as we think. Sometimes it's just as deep and dark as someone's bedroom and their dark closet and whatever the hell they're conjuring up. Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and author of this book, Unbreakable Alliances, wherever books are sold, and other ones too, The Code of Trust. You can get it right now. But wait, there's more. There's also this one too. And if you call right now, we'll throw in a juicer. No, I'm kidding. Just go get them wherever books are sold. Going back to the Ronco commercial days, I always wanted that little juicer they would give you if you bought the Miracle Blade. It's a little plastic thing. Right now, Mom, can we get it? I know I can't use knives, but I love the juicer.
Slap chop. Remember Slap Chop?
Slap Chop. Yes, exactly. It's like them cutting through shoes and metal. That was always fun too. Like, in case you want to cut up a plumbing piece of your home, you can do that and carve the turkey in the same setting. Anyway,
cleaned it first.
Exactly.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.